Fox Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 1065. Thank you for joining us this morning. Almost made it through another week, counting my blessings for sure. Haven't been fired yet. The key still works on the door, on the lock. I am thrilled to be here and grateful to Sean Sullivan, who has taken over production duties here, holding my hand through this this process. But always great to be with you. Like I said, survived another week. That is pretty good sign for the future, at least for Monday, as far as I'm concerned. Still to come on the program today, State Senator Chris Elliott will join us at the bottom of the hour. Make sure that you stay tuned for that. But joining us now in studio, delighted to introduce my next guest, State Auditor Jim Ziegler. Jim, how are you today?
Good, very good. Thank you. This is the first time I've been invited on the new Jeff Poor South show. I've been on the Jeff Poor North show, but glad to have you back in God's country.
We have made the migration completely south now, so you got me here. At least till something goes awry, but I anticipate that not happening. What to get you in here? A bunch of municipal elections going on the Eastern Shore, and with this whole toll bridge issue, which you really kind of made a focus of yours, came about. You put the pressure on the local officials to get activated and active, and just opposing a toll altogether. With these municipal elections now, how big of a deal was their stance in that whole toll bridge era in 2019? Now,
well, the local officials ended up in the end blocking the toll bridge, and the Eastern Shore Metropolitan Planning Organization, ESMPO, cast the vote on August 28th of last year, almost a year ago, and they voted 8-1 to take the toll out of the TIP, the Transportation Improvement Plan. And within 2 minutes of that vote, Governor Ivey put out a news release. I've never seen one put out that quickly, stating that there's no path going forward, and she pull the plug on the toll plan, which was our goal to begin with. That toll plan was the worst plan I've ever seen concocted by the minds of politicians, and that covers a lot. That covers a lot of
ground. Well, I noted it was politicians, unless you count, obviously, Governor Ivey a politician, but it seemed to come from within the bureaucracy of the state government that this was almost apolitical in some ways.
Well, ALDOT was very much behind this, and the ALDOT director.
And we don't vote on John Cooper, the ALDOT director.
No, we don't. And so it was his and Governor Ivey's plan more than anybody else, and they were simply not able to go forward with the thing being removed from the Transportation Improvement Plan, and that was a year ago. Now, the only one of the members of that board that voted yes was the ALDOT representative. The ALDOT district director is on that board, and he voted yes, but all eight of the elected officials on the board unanimously voted no, and a number of them are up for re-election a week from Tuesday, which is August 25th. When we were running the opposition to the toll bridge, we said at that time that we're going to take notes as to what officials helped us and who didn't, and that come election time we would put that information back out. Well, this is election time, so as it turns out, the people who disagree with us, the people that want to represent only the developers and the people that are getting government contracts and the toll bridges and whatever, those folks have decided to make their ground zero Fairhope, Alabama, which has a municipal election on August 25th. And they chose that ground, and they are opposing the re-election of Mayor Karen Wilson. They're running three candidates for the city council, which would compose a majority. And so we're putting this information out. We've been putting out about a week to our 52,000 plus members. And interestingly, 2,200 of them live in Fairhope. Can you imagine what kind of an effect that can have? Now, since we were blessed to beat the toll a year ago, we got involved in the vote no on Amendment 1 in the March 3rd primary, and that would have taken away the right of people to vote for or against the State Board of Education members,
right,
and make them all appointed by the governor. Well, our people were 100% against that, so we led the campaign, and we beat that thing 75% no, 25% yes. Now, that somebody in Montgomery should be humiliated by that vote. The people didn't just say no, they said heck no.
Well, and the two are related in this fashion, that we saw what happens when you don't have elected representatives involved in a toll process. And that builds up this distrust of government, state government, particularly in this part of the state. But you translate that, hey, we're the same people that messed this up. Let us take the reins here on the State Board of Education. Is that kind of the, you know, they're parallel in that way?
Well, they certainly are. And any time the people's right to vote is taken away, then the accountability drops to usually to zero. Who they're accountable to moves from the taxpaying public over to the Montgomery bureaucrats.
Right.
And so we were just so pleased to be able to lead the opposition and beat that Amendment 1. And we also noticed that Mobile County Commissioner Jared Carl had drawn up the initial resolution to remove the toll from the transportation improvement plan at the Mobile MPO, of which he's a member. And he took a lead, and we highlighted that at that time. We weren't endorsing anybody or against anybody. We just told what he did. And we told it a number of times prior to the July 14th runoff. And the people responded. And with him winning 52% to 48%, we feel like our 52,000 voters made a difference.
Well, let's backtrack on something you said that you caught my attention. You talk about the Fairhope municipal election. That seems to be, there's a lot of interest. It's very compelling, just because of all the parts and pieces of what goes on in the city of Fairhope. But you're telling me that there is a movement afoot to unseat some of the people that are in Fairhope right now, because it's tied to the bridge, but maybe tied to development. Well, hash that out for us, if you would.
Well, there is a political machine in Baldwin County, Alabama. For several years, it's been called Catalyst, a kind of an intimidating sounding name. They're a Catalyst candidate.
It's the old Lynn Stacy group, right?
Well, he's dead now, so
right. So it's
but it's continuing. They found out they'd gotten a bad impression on a lot of Baldwin County people, and so they changed their name. They pulled a slicky, and it sounds pretty harmless now. Scott Boone Consulting. And they recruit candidates, back candidates, run campaigns for candidates in municipal elections and county commission and state legislative candidates in Baldwin County. And right now, of course, their focus, and therefore our focus, they've picked Fairhope as their ground zero. They're trying to defeat Mayor Karen Wilson. They're trying to take over a lock, stock of the city council with three city council candidates. And we hope that people in Fairhope will do their homework and figure out who is accountable to the Catalyst group and not vote for them, and who are the other candidates who can be accountable to the taxpaying public.
I mean, a lot of the politics there, it just sounds like you have people that are for development, and then are kind of anti-development. Is that where the fault line is?
Well, it's not anti-development. You have some politicians and supporters of politicians who are just for unbridled, unregulated development. Now, I'm against that. And they don't care anything about preserving the lifestyle of Baldwin County, preserving the what's left of the peace and quiet, and it to be a wonderful place for families to live and recreation. They just want they would pave the entirety of Baldwin County if they could figure out how to make a dollar out of doing that. Now, that overdevelopment, unregulated development, that's what people are against, and I agree with the people.
So it's putting curbs in place there, I guess, is the idea. Like, it's the bridge was a part of that because it would have brought more people from Mobile. Just walk us through that.
Well, yes, the there are two schools of thought among our 50,000 people about the Bayway, how to get from Mobile to Baldwin County and back.
Right.
And there's one group that thinks that we definitely need a new bridge and don't need to depend on the Bankhead Tunnel and the Wallace I-10 Tunnel. There's another group that thinks, no, you can fix the I-10. You can fix the western entrance from the Mobile side into the Wallace Tunnel.
That's where the bottleneck is, if you're going around the curve, right?
That it is an engineering marvel of what not to do. And you can do certain things to make people pick up their speed. They slow down to enter from the western side, and then they don't speed back up. Well, you've got to give them better signals and ticket a few people and do a public information campaign to get people, once they get in the tunnel, to resume the speed. Also, if stay in the right lane. Unless you're passing somebody, stay in the right lane. These things, and there are various other things that can be done that could fix the Bayway. And so half our group wants to just fix the existing Bayway, and the other half want a new bridge.
Right. So within the new bridge, as long as it's not a toll bridge.
Correct. There was money to build the bridge. But when Aldott and their backers figured out that they could bring in what's called a P3 partner.
Public-private partnership.
Yes. The cost of that bridge went up to $2.1 billion. And they were going to give the investors a 55-year lease on an interstate highway. Now, that just right there turns off many, many people. I didn't realize before this that you could give somebody a lease on a portion of an interstate highway. I'm afraid President Eisenhower, who was the father of the interstate system, is turning over in his grave with the idea that his freeway would have toll bridges. And there are a few, and this would have been the worst. And they could have built this. We identified a half dozen sources of money to build the basic bridge, not the Taj Mahal bridge with all the add-ons, but in our book that we wrote about this whole movement, we identified the money.
All right, we're gonna hold you over for one more segment here and get a commercial in, and we'll talk about the Office of State Auditor when we get back. Stay tuned, folks. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. And welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. A little Leonard Skinner playing us in there on this Friday morning. Still to come on the program, State Senator Chris Elias. He will be with us in the next segment, so make sure you stay tuned for that. Still in studio with us, our good friend, State Auditor Jim Ziegler. By the way, got the book out now. It's in print. If you haven't seen the PDF, but if you want it for your bookcase, Blocking the I-10 Toll Scheme, A Successful Citizen Movement by Jim Ziegler. Tell folks where they can find this book, or should they seek it.
Well, they can get a free copy by going to our Facebook page, which is Block the Tolls, and just simply download onto whatever electronic device they use. Now, if they want a print copy, the printer likes to be paid.
Yes.
And so they can order one from the publisher, which is Lulu, LULU.com. It's a Lulu of a book. And the cost is $20.22. And, of course, that symbolizes the 2022 next state elections.
Right.
And this toll issue, we're going to bring it back up and, again, point out just the facts, who helped us and who didn't.
Let's shift gears here. The Office of the State Auditor debated in the legislature last session. There was a movement afoot to change it or do away with it.
Yes.
Give us kind of the rundown of where we are with that whole debate right now.
Well, between our supporters who support the State Auditor's Office and support me, and the COVID epidemic, we're able to beat off those two bills to abolish the State Auditor's Office. And there's every chance in the regular session of February of 2021 coming up in 7 months that we would see yet another attempt to abolish the State Auditor's Office. And strangest thing, with all the relatively quiet state auditors that didn't question every blooming thing that came by, you never saw a move to abolish the state auditors. But I get in there, and the whole time they've been messing with it. Now, when they couldn't get that done, they came back and decided our already slim budget, they'll cut it another 47%. And, man, we had to, and they did this in the dark of the night, and we had to get the troops organized very quickly during the pandemic, and we were able to moderate that, and they only cut us 11% from an already slim budget. But the 47% would have put us under.
Let's talk about the role of the state officer, the auditor, as it is constituted now. Your primary focus, or not your sole focus, if I'm getting this right, it's property. It's
that's correct. Our main duty is to inventory the roughly 300,000 items of state-owned property that cost $500 or higher each, and when I went in 5.5 years ago, we had a slim budget and a slim staff. We had 11 staff members to audit 176 state agencies every 2 years. So the legislature, in their wisdom, cut us 28.5% during the Bentley era. Of course, I had filed the initial ethics complaint against Governor Bentley, which eventually was ruled in my favor on that. And then they cut our staff in half, from 11 to 5.5. Now, the 5, that wasn't so bad, but that half an employee, that's what got us. And it's not easy, but by conserving every dollar and by smart management, we're current on all the audits of the 176 state agencies, and we've actually lowered the amount of lost and missing state property. So we've done more with less, but if we get even less than that, we may not be able to keep it up.
It's just 100. How many state agencies?
176.
That is incredible, because I would have thought 20 maybe. 176.
Yes. Now, most of them you never heard of. You know, the Manure Commission and things of
that's
of
a that real name. Thing.
No, that some.
I mean, we wouldn't put it past folks, you know.
But I should bring you a list of some of the stranger state agencies that are out there, and it's almost funny, some of them. But you know, you've heard of the big boys, ALDOT and the
right.
Department of Corrections and whatnot. But we're keeping up with it, and not only that, but we're bringing the auditing process into the 21st century with what's called RFID, radio frequency identification. Right now, we've got an old-fashioned barcode glued to every item of state property, and we'll have, instead, a chip.
Oh, well, that'll make things a lot easier. Hey, we got to scoot here. We got to get to break here, but thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you. Thank you. This is a very poor show.
Well, it is indeed. We got to take a timeout, folks. We will return. It's the FM Talk 106.5. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Coming up Monday on the program from WVNN, a former colleague of mine, Dale Jackson, will be with us, and also State Representative Matt Simpson. So make sure you tune in on Monday. Big show planned as well for Monday. But join us now on the line, our usual Friday guest. Always a pleasure to introduce him. He represents the folks over in Baldwin County, across the bay there, State Senator Chris Elliott. Senator, how are you today?
I am great. Thanks for having me on again.
Hey, thanks for making time for us. So let's get an update here. How are things going for you, your family, COVID-19, still making it?
Still making it interesting, that's for sure. Things are going well so far. You know, third day of school in Baldwin County for Baldwin County kids and mine as well. But aside from the mask, everything seems to be pretty much back to normal, as is reported by my kids. School system being very proactive and looking at things, and things seem to be going pretty well.
Yeah, because I live in Daphne. When I leave, I see the bus stops, the kids there, and they have masks on. Other than that, at face value, it seems things are kind of going as you know they would otherwise.
Well, and of course, the real testament to that will be weeks and weeks down the road to see how this progresses. But even the reports that are being put out by the county school system and about how many students are not in school or never came to school because they exhibited symptoms seems to indicate that, you know, the parents are taking this seriously as well and doing what they're supposed to do to keep their kids out of school, even if they're showing symptoms. You know, testing is taking so long to turn around that you almost are having to base this off of nothing but symptoms in order to make a decision about whether or not to keep your kids home.
Yeah, because it's such a lagging indicator. It takes a while for those test results to come in, and by the time you get the results and you know that you're positive, well, you may very well have you've already exposed people or the classroom to COVID-19. I mean, that seems like the only system or the only option that we have in place. Is there anything better?
I don't think so, unfortunately. In my discussions with the Department of Health and of course, very close discussions with the school board here locally, are that the best thing we can go from right now is going to be symptoms. And of course, that's not perfect, not by a long shot with a lot of folks that are completely asymptomatic. But if you're relying on a test to determine whether or not you you have COVID while you are exhibiting symptoms and still interacting with other people, that's not a good thing. You've got symptoms, stay home, period.
Yeah, well, it's one thing to be asymptomatic, but to have symptoms, the sneezing or coughing or anything like that, that would tend to make, you know, to make things spread a little differently.
Exactly.
Right. And that's, I guess that's the wisdom there. But I assume they got other protocols in place with social distancing, mask, and they're maybe taking temperatures or something like that.
They're doing that. The county school system's installed a number of cameras in each school, thermal cameras that are taking readings of kids as they move about the school, as they come into the school. And if there is a child that that shows, you know, that they're running the temperature, and I forget exactly, I think 100.4 sticking in my head for some reason, that may not be completely accurate, but then the nurse is identifying that child as maybe having an issue. And they've got protocol in place that honestly I think are as good as it can be. And then on top of that, they're generating a daily report. You know, they're calling it a transparency report that indicates exactly what happened the previous day, how many kids, and what they're seeing, so that parents can be as informed as possible.
Are you hearing anything about this? When they first did the mask mandate for school children, there was a little bit of pushback that, you know, it's hard to manage second graders. Furthermore, make sure they're not goofing off and wearing the mask or wearing it properly or whatever. Has that been an issue? Although it's very, very, very early in all this, have you heard anything like that?
I have a very reliable report from a 7-year-old.
Fantastic.
You know, my son told me that. So, you know, he said, "Look, there are kids that are, you know, the teacher's having to stay on and make sure they're wearing it correctly. You know." And that they've got it, you know, got it covered both their nose and their mouth, and I think that's all to be expected. I mean, heck, I've got, you know, problems making sure he's got the same socks on and wearing underwear sometimes. So, you know, that's part of, you know, being a kid, and I think that's something that we're going to continue to see.
The challenges of a parent. I'm really looking forward to that. They're setting me up real nicely there, Senator.
You're going to have fun. It's great.
Other than that, everything else, I don't know, like we're kind of in a place now where we're still in this wait-and-see holding pattern with masks, but there's, since the last time we talked, it does seem as if the trend is maybe in a better direction, I wouldn't say quite positive, but not as bad.
Well, and I think that's going to be what we're going to see moving forward, and we're going to have, you know, we're going to have a wave, if you will, and maybe, you know, I'm a guy from down on the water, maybe the intervals aren't as tight, right? But we're going to see this up and down motion, I think, for a while until a vaccine is ready and on board. And I know that is not comforting to a lot of people who want to say, let's wear a mask, let's shut down, and let's, you know, hunker down for a couple of months. I think this is going to be something that's around for quite a while.
Yeah, and it's just adapting to it. But even if it looks like we're in the clear, it still seems to me that, well, let's just be safe. It's better safe than sorry. Let's continue some of these mandates until we really know for sure.
Well, and I think it goes back even more so to personal responsibility. And it is a law of averages. The less people you interact with directly, the less chance you have of spreading this. If it's an activity where you have to be face to face, okay. But if it's one of those things where you can opt for a video conference, if you can opt for a phone call, if you can opt for not being face to face, then that's probably something you ought to look at. And I think if we just look at the math on this and understand the probabilities, then that is going to be as effective as anything else.
Well, I think that. But getting back to that point, I think that's a reluctance. Whatever Governor Ivey or Scott Harris come out, the state health officer, Scott Harris, come out with a new mandate or a new rule or a new guideline or protocol, rolling it back doesn't seem to be as easy as rolling it out. That you know, with taking something away, or God forbid, government like taking a step back from its power. To a lot of people in their mind, they see this and, oh, this is another thing we're going to be stuck with long probably after this is due. So you understand, and tell me this is your sense, though, why there's such pushback from some of these things that just seem otherwise not that big of a deal. You could do this. You could survive this way. It's just for a little while. People are skeptical of that whole notion.
Alabamians do not like being told what to do by government. That should not come as a surprise to anyone. And I think that you couple that with some of the data problems that we've had early on, some of the guidance that has changed, in all fairness, because nobody's seen this virus before, and it's changing. The guidance has changed. So you have to, wonder, and there is an underlying skepticism. Do these folks that are issuing these orders really know what's going on? And I think the answer is, by and large, they don't know everything that's going on. They know some things, and they're making the best decision that they can. But that may prove to not be accurate weeks later, and that breeds doubt in the public's mind about whether or not it's something that they should be doing or that they have to do. I think there's some underlying trust issues as well with those, you know, that are governing that you've got to take into account too. You know, is this somebody that you trust to be giving you advice on this or not? And that is a political problem more than anything else.
Well, let me draw this analogy. It's kind of like when the EU or the United Nations or whatever issue some kind of directive, and people in this country are like, we don't answer to this global body here. We don't, you know, and the same to me seems like it should apply to the state where you have the CDC or, you know, they're issuing guidelines or you know, the World Health Organization or whatever big entity you want to use in there. That we voted for the governor, that we voted for the legislature. We didn't get to vote for the state health officer, but we voted these people, and we didn't vote for these big, enormous bureaucracies that are making decisions for us. And that's where you get some of the pushback.
Well, that is true, but it is also true that when the folks that we voted in, these small government conservatives, start acting like big government bureaucracies, that folks start questioning that as well.
Yeah, well, I fully anticipate, though, that when you guys finally get the opportunity to gavel in, probably won't be until 2021 that one of the big things that's going to be done is there's going to be either a revisiting, if not a total overhaul of the system.
There has to be. I mean, there's no question about that. The thought that we can live under emergency powers for months and months, maybe even a year or two at a time, and that is somehow or another permitted and legal, where the executive has as much unchecked and unbridled power as they currently do, is not something that the people of Alabama signed up for. And to the extent that is something that is in the Emergency Powers Act, that's going to be changed. There's no question in my mind.
I mean, isn't that the fear why we have it? And I guess I'm asking you to speculate here, but while we haven't had a special session to really do with anything, just given the Republican majorities and the numbers, you have the numbers in both the House and the Senate to override whatever Governor Ivey, or if she called a special session, whatever parameters she set in place. Is that why we're not seeing the legislature called in to deal with any of this? That you know, we may be being told, hey, everything is fine, we don't need a special session. Or in addition to that, there's the health risk. We don't want to deal with that. That might have something to do with it, why we're not seeing maybe more activity there on that end.
Well, Jeff, you'll have to ask the governor why in the world she's not calling a special session. But there are plenty of crucial issues that did not get solved in the last session before we adjourned due to coronavirus that absolutely need to take place. I mean, there are economic development incentive bills that need to get addressed. There are huge projects, you know, across the state that are definitely dependent on that being addressed, and those expire prior to the next session. They need to be addressed. There are liability concerns, Senator Orr's bill, that absolutely need to be addressed. There are issues with the prisons that need to be addressed. There are issues with taxation on the stimulus payments. And PPP loans. I filed that bill last session that need to be addressed. Otherwise, they'll have to pass in the very first days of the session in March to get done between the first day and when business tax filings are due. I mean, all of those forgivable PPP loans are currently taxable. Think about that for small business impact. We need to change that. I cannot imagine why in the world the governor would not go ahead and call us back into special session unless it is exactly as you suppose, and that is they don't want us in there because they do not want us addressing the emergency powers that she currently has. And I think that's a shame.
Right, and I mean, or even it was the, it seemed like you know, the end of the tail end of the last session, the CARES Act money too, you know, and the governor's office thought that they were going to be able to be distributing that, but as long as I'm not the only one that thinks this is kind of a weird time right now, not to at least even engage in discussions about a special session, that it is, it you know, whenever you bring it up or it's talked about around the governor, it's a non-starter. It's off the table.
And you have to wonder, why in the world is that? And the only logical answer is that she is afraid of what the legislature will do if they come back. And that is the only thing that makes sense to say.
Right. Are you hearing from anybody else? Any of your colleagues that are like, hey, shouldn't we at least be in Montgomery discussing the economic incentive issue or this prison thing that seems like it could be really big if it's not nipped in the bud? But is anybody saying, hey, why aren't we convening a special session?
I think that my colleagues are of similar mind and understand that the governor is worried about what we may do, what bills we may take up, and frankly, what bills there is broad support to take up that might have to do with her authority power. And you're exactly right, the money that she currently has control over, and whether or not there'd be any attempt to make adjustments to that. Those are concerns that I think exist. Again, I cannot figure out a way to justify not calling the legislature back into session. And to the extent that somebody says it's because of health risk, I simply don't buy that. I mean, we are sending our kids back to school. The absolutely least we could do is ask the legislature to come back to work.
Well, Senator, just real quick, we got to wrap it up here, but it's going to happen eventually. You guys are going to be back into session at some point in time. It cannot be, this cannot be kicked down the road indefinitely. So, like, wouldn't it... It seems to me it would behoove the governor, the governor's office, to say, okay, let's get at the table, negotiate something. We'll call it a special session. But as far as I can tell, maybe you're privy to something that I'm not, that there's just no appetite for that whatsoever.
Well, and I think you're right. I would agree that the governor should sit down with the legislature and try to figure out a way to discuss these types of issues ahead of time and come up with a solution that everybody's comfortable with. But that has not been the MO of this governor. That has not been the MO of this chief of staff. And that does not seem to be the way they are going to handle this.
So we got to leave it there. But as always, thank you for making time for us on Friday mornings. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, Jeff. Thanks again.
That was State Senator Chris Elliott kind of talking about where we are right now and why we're not seeing more activity going on in Montgomery. Seems like a prime time for it. Got to take a break. We'll come back, wrap it all up. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Mona tried to tell me to stay away from the train line. She said that all the railroad men just drink up your blood like wine.
Hey, I was country.
And welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Coming up on Monday, Dale Jackson from WVNN and State Representative Matt Simpson and some guests to be named later. So make sure you tune in on Monday, as I have almost made it through my second week of programming here.
That's right.
I feel very good at where I'm at, but I don't want to get too cocky just yet. I'm still like double secret probation over here. Sean Sullivan, you hear him in the mornings here on Mobile Mornings and Midday Mobile here in just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I defer to you on all things outdoors because I don't really,
You spend as little time outdoors as possible.
And I would like to spend more time outdoors. It's just, well, it's very low on my list of priorities. But I was talking to somebody yesterday, and with COVID-19 taking away college football.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about state parks are going to see off the charts, participation or attendance or whatever. But also, outdoors activities. And I know you may address this in a later future program, but the idea that we're going to see more people in the woods come deer season, more people out on the lakes fishing.
Oh, it's already, you know, it's already happening. We've talked about it in the past on the Outdoor Show. Yeah, we'll talk about it some tomorrow morning when Mike Ward and I have FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors at 7. But there's some real things. There's some real test cases. Two of them I can point out real quickly here in Alabama. Number one, the turkey season numbers. So we were under quarantine during turkey season. A lot of people couldn't go to work. Now, I know this isn't like college football, but they couldn't go do other things. The harvest levels were way higher than normal because people had more days that they weren't doing whatever else they were doing. And then the red snapper early closure is a prime example of that. The number of boats, the number of trips per day went up by hundreds from year to year. And that's why we reached our quota so fast for snapper, because of that. So this fall, with no college football, and then some people working from home and doing different things, public lands will have a lot more people on them in the state. Lakes will have a lot more. We're already, the DCNR is already talking about trying to how to prepare for that. So maybe we can do more on this down the road. I get you some guests from DCNR. You
know, yeah, so. I mean, I, it's a fascinating phenomenon just culturally and what that means. But we gotta call it a day. Have everyone has a good weekend. Headed off to Sean Sullivan here, Midday Mobile. This has been the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5.